Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome to the Standard Model and Beyond. Of course. So, by way of introduction, so I'm Latham Boyle. My office, if you have any questions or anything, you can feel free to drop by or send me an email that you want to drop by. My office is 330. My email is like so. Okay. So, briefly, what's the course about? You know, I like to describe it. I think of this topic as, well, it's about, you know, it's about sort of the ultimate puzzle, basically the greatest puzzle there is, as far as I'm concerned, which is, so humans have been trying to figure out for a few thousand years now what everything is made of, and how it works, so there was some very slow progress, and then about 400 years ago things began to pick up steam, and then in the past century things really began to pick up steam, and so we have some situation where there's sort of if you want on the table there's some bit of puzzle which has been put together by many people over 400 years. And this is sort of maybe, you might say, the part of the puzzle that you're sure about. And then also on the table, there's sort of a bunch of other, at this point, pieces which are clearly part of the puzzle but haven't yet been successfully fit in. These are somehow different theoretical ideas or experimental results that that either no one's figured out how to put them in here or no one can agree on how they fit into this puzzle. And then every once in a while some new experiment or a theoretical idea introduces some new piece of the puzzle. And so roughly speaking, the first half of the course will be about explaining the current state of the puzzle, so basically this part, if you want, getting the logical structure right, getting some intuition for it, and then also explaining what are the puzzling features about this puzzle. So if you want, there's some over here. You know, at the edge of the puzzle here, you see someone getting stabbed, but you can't see who's stabbing them, and so we first half of the course will be about this part of the puzzle, and then the second half will be about these pieces, various attempts to fit them in, and also what are, in my personal opinion, the best ideas we have about what the next steps in adding to this puzzle might be. In some sense, the philosophy will be, it's important to understand this is like a very important puzzle, and every piece here, every time someone fits one piece in, it's not like an ordinary puzzle. Every time here you get one more piece in the puzzle, that person gets a Nobel Prize. And but so the emphasis on this course will be on what are the most, if you want, promising ideas for what the next little piece is. There are other, of course, ideas in high energy physics that are more about sort of I have in mind in particular string theory, which are in some sense more grand visions for sort of what the whole picture might, grand guesses about what the whole puzzle might look like. But although I may be wrong, they're probably not, where the next piece of definite progress will come from. So anyway, but as I say, that could be right or could be wrong. But I will be focusing on the things that look to me like the most promising next steps. What else did I? Well, okay. So maybe I'll just I was just going to give a rough outline of of what I would try to cover when. Okay, so today, so roughly speaking, there's if I'm not mistaken, there's 26 lectures in the course, and I was going to basically do the first 13 on basically the standard model and things related to if you want this blob, and then the final 13 lectures on other stuff. And so in more detail, so today I was going to begin with a introduction discussing some mathematical preliminaries we'll need for later in the course, and then also that'll hopefully serve as a motivation, as we'll see, for what'll come later. Tomorrow I'll introduce or review, depending on your background, gauge theory / Yang-Mills theory. Because the standard model, as we currently understand it, is an example of such a theory. Let's see, lectures 3 through 5. I was basically going to, So here we'll introduce gauge theories in general. The standard model is a particular example of such a gauge theory. So we basically want to introduce what is the logical. Lectures 3 through 5 will introduce the standard model itself. So we'll sort of summarize the logical structure of it as succinctly as possible. Write down the Lagrangian and get to know and love it. Understand what are the physical parameters in the Lagrangian. And then this will also involve a discussion of gauge and global anomalies, gauge and global symmetries, and then gauge and global anomalies in the standard model in particular. So then lectures 6 and 7, I was going to, so once we've understood the standard model, famous fact about the standard model is that it has more symmetry than we see at low energies. There's this phenomenon of spontaneous symmetry breaking or the Higgs mechanism, which is very important in terms of translating the model phrased in its most beautiful form with the actual thing we need to calculate the results of experiments. And so I'm going to give two lectures to really clearly understanding spontaneous symmetry breaking in the Higgs mechanism, again in general, and then in the standard model in particular. In particular, there'll roughly speaking be one lecture about understanding the bosonic aspects, and then one about the fermionic aspects. Lectures 8 and 9. I was going to basically talk about phenomenology. So experiments history. So by this I mean basically, you know, okay, so we've written down this model. Now you want to actually do physics with it. You want to in particular determine what's possible and what's not possible, and when something is possible, how likely is it? So we want to make sure we understand how to do that once we have our model. And then, like all intelligent people, you don't just want to be handed a model and told that it's true as a religious doctrine. You want to know, you know, where it came from and how we. There's a very fascinating story about how people decided over the past century that this was that this model was right, or at least very approximately right. Okay, so let's see. Lecture 10, I have sort of an introduction to effective field theory and the renormalization group and their application to the standard model. And then that'll be a good time to take stock of what are the various outstanding puzzles and unexplained patterns in the model. Lecture 11 will be devoted to neutrinos. This is, in some sense, well, there's all sorts of different mysterious things about the standard model, but this is one of the parts of the standard model where it's not only mysterious, but we have most recently made progress in understanding it. We've learned more about it and have a good chance of learning yet more about it in the near future. And it's also a very confusing part of the standard model and probably related to a bunch of other mysterious parts of the standard model. So these guys get their own lecture. And then that'll lead us to lecture 12, which is about hints to what extent the standard model does explain what we observe out there in the universe cosmologically, to what extent it doesn't, and how neutrinos relate to all of this. And then finally, I was going to discuss something else we've learned just in recent years with the discovery of the Higgs boson, is that there appears to be something interesting going on in the standard model having to do when you think about running couplings, the RG flow of the couplings, so-called Landau poles, and the stability or instability of the Higgs potential. Okay, so that's my current sketch of the first half of the course. I would not bet anything too valuable to me on the truth of this outline, on the precise truth of it. I think it's there's the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. This is roughly right. Okay. But sometimes something takes half as long to explain as I thought, or twice as long, or people have questions about something. Or also, I should mention, you know, if there's something that you guys are particularly interested to hear about, that's also let me know. In fact, that would kind of be a dream, maybe. If like fantasy of mine. Tell me what you want to hear about. I would just talk about that. But okay, so anyway, so the second half of the course, the outline is even more sketchy, I must say. So I was thinking lectures 14 through 17, I would discuss grand unification. So this is something that was discovered, set of ideas that were discovered right after the standard model was discovered, already in the 1970s. And well, you just can't think about physics beyond the standard model without understanding this, because it's clearly an insight about something in the standard model, as I'll explain. There's somehow good news and bad news here. And the good news is so good that it's clearly not a coincidence. It's somehow connected to some kernel of truth, but the bad news is sufficiently bad that it's clearly not the actual, well, at least several of the grand unified models are not the actual truth. And it's still possible in principle it's still possible that grand unification is honest to God correct, although I wouldn't bet on it. But anyway, so the bad news is sufficiently bad that, you know, there's something wrong about this idea, but there's also something right about it. So I think that's a key thing we want to understand. I should say, by the way, there's one bit of beyond the standard model physics which I sneak into the first half of the course, which is about right-handed neutrinos. Strictly speaking, right-handed neutrinos are not part of the standard model of particle physics. But they are, if you want, our most the most likely. So they haven't been directly observed, but it's more likely than not that they are present for reasons I'll try to explain. So let's say that the next most clearly or most likely to be something related to some real insight about the next step in the puzzle is grand unification, I'd say. Okay, so, or at least among classical old ideas. So then I was gonna do two lectures about the so-called strong CP problem. And propose solutions. So one of those proposed solutions is the axion. Then, you know, a basic puzzle about the standard model is why three families. Why does everything come in three copies? Nobody knows the answer. It's an obvious pattern in the model. I'll explain some of the best ideas that have been given for that and why none of them has emerged as a really compelling idea, what the sort of snags are at the moment. I wanted to give one lecture to prion models. You see, the development of particle physics has gone in waves where sometimes the number of fundamental particles expands and you explain various puzzles and new phenomena by realizing, our list of particles was incomplete. But then sometimes it goes in the other direction. Sometimes you realize, oh, actually our list of particles was overcomplete. There are fewer particles than we thought there were. And actually the particles we used to think were the fundamental particles are actually made from a smaller set of more elementary particles. So the most famous example of this is the periodic table. You know, people thought there were of order 100 atoms, but then it turned out that they were all made from three particles, protons, neutrons, and electrons. And then another example was when people discovered that all the baryons and mesons really were made of three, or now we would say six, quarks. So most ideas about physics beyond the standard model at the moment, including this one, are ideas about extensions in which there are more particles than in the current standard model. But then there have also been some interesting, although it must be said less successful ideas that go the other direction, that imagine that the particles we see in the standard model aren't the fundamental particles, and that there's a smaller set of fundamental particles that explain some of the patterns. And so anyway, there have been some quite intriguing proposals about this, and I just want to describe those because they're interesting. And then finally, and you know, they're not quite right, the ones that have been found so far, but it could be on the right track in some way. Now finally, okay, my current plan is this. So there is one other thing which I rank now as interesting as this, which was discovered just about a year and a half ago. which is, there's this 86-year-old Bulgarian mathematician named Ivan Todorov. He's a great guy. He was like one of the pioneers of conformal field theory and the conformal bootstrap in the 1970s. But anyway, it turns out that he and I have both been obsessed. I didn't know this until last year, but he and I have both been obsessed with something called the exceptional Jordan algebra. And the so-called magic square. And their possible relation to the standard model. But I could never get it to quite work, and somehow he beat me to it. He realized something which I think is very striking and not yet widely appreciated about the relationship of this thing to the standard model. And then I haven't yet put out a paper about this, but I probably will in some point in the middle of the course, about a sort of next step beyond what he realized, which I'm excited about, which has to do with this magic square. It all relates to this. And so I think what I want to do is that, well, I definitely want to explain his idea. But then I've, assuming I do manage to get my paper out in time, I was going to give the final few lectures to explain that whole story properly. Okay, so that's the proposed outline. Any questions about that before I plunge ahead? Yes.
I'm just wondering what the masses of the prions would be.
What the masses of the prions would be?
Proposed masses.
Well, that's, first of all, this is actually a puzzle. One of the problems with prion models is that it's the bottom line is that there's no, let's say, there's no model that is successful enough that you can really calculate from first principles the relationship between the masses of the fundamental particles and the masses of the various standard model particles that we see. So in short, nobody knows. But one of the difficulties with prion models exactly relates to how that should work. Because if it's I should explain that when we get to this lecture. But the short story is nobody knows, and then to add to that, that there's something puzzling about how you could have a prion model that's compatible with experiment, and yet produce observed masses that are so light for all of the bound particles. And that's related to what the mass of the more fundamental particles would have to be in order to have evaded more direct detection. Okay, so let's see. Maybe I'll move over here now. Well, you know, I don't like this board because... Let's see there. Now, can you see more or less of the board if I do that? But you guys are mostly actually over here. I kind of like this board better because it's more visible. I'm an indecisive board user. Okay, so for the rest of the lecture, I was going to discuss some mathematical preliminaries that'll be important for the rest of the course. And let's summarize. I'm going to start very simple and then build up here. So in short, I'm going to start by introducing something that you all know, vector spaces, and then it'll be very brief, and then from that we'll meet algebras. And so in particular, we'll meet the normed division algebras, Lie algebras, um, then we'll briefly look at how the we'll briefly review what groups are, and in particular the classification of Lie groups, and how it's sort of simplified by using these norm division algebras. And then finally, we'll go on a grand brief tour of how the norm division algebras not only simplify the classification of Lie algebras and Lie groups, but the classification of all sorts of things all over mathematics. And that this pattern shows up that whenever you classify things, there are a few normal cases which correspond to the simple norm division algebras, and then a few handful of exceptional cases which correspond to the Octonians. And in particular, we'll briefly meet the exceptional Jordan algebra, which we'll come back later. Okay, so okay. So, for starters, I know, starting too simple, but so, because it'll be helpful in what comes next, let's just quickly review. A vector space over some field F okay, well, first of all, remember, or you maybe remember, or maybe I'll tell you if you don't know. So mathematicians, when they say a field, they mean something different than what physicists mean. They mean something the two examples we'll really care about in this. These are the scalars. When you have a vector space, you can multiply vectors by a scalar. Those scalars technically have to come from something called a field, which is a set of elements where you can basically multiply them and divide them. Both operations are commutative. They distribute over one another, and every element has a multiplicative inverse except for zero. So the classic examples of a field are the real numbers and the complex numbers, and in this course, those are the only examples of a field we're going to need. So the scalars in the vector space will always be drawn from here. So a vector space, what is it? Well, it's a set of elements V such that you can add them. So V1 and V2 are in the vector space. If V1 plus V2 is in the vector space, if V1 and V2 separately are in the vector space. And then you can multiply a vector by a scalar to get another vector. Okay, so lambda times V is in V if lambda is from the field of scalars and V is an element of the vector space. Okay, that's what a vector space is, and as you all know, a key thing about vector spaces is that you can take a basis for the vector space and express any element in that basis. So you can write any vector in the vector space V as some linear combination of basis elements EI times coefficients, scalar coefficients lambda I. And here I'm using this notation where if the index is doubled, I'm summing over it. So this is really shorthand for sum over all basis vectors I of lambda I times EI. Okay, so much for vector spaces. Hopefully you've all met them. Next comes an algebra. Okay, so an algebra is just a vector space with one additional property, which is that you can multiply two vectors to get another vector. Okay, so there's some product, some bilinear product, formally you express that by saying there's some bilinear product from the vector space A tensor A into A. So an element of this vector space is really, okay. So just to be more concrete, What I mean when I say it's a bilinear product, well, I just mean that to specify the product of any two vectors in A, let's say two vectors A and A prime. If I want to specify their product, well, for arbitrary vectors A and A prime, it's enough to first tell you what the product is of any two basis vectors. So let me first tell you the product of any two basis vectors, EI and EJ. Oh, how's the size of my writing? Can you guys read what I'm writing? OK. So well, let me make it bigger. Anyway. So if you take two basis vectors, EI and EJ, their product will be some other vector in the vector space. So we can express that product as a linear combination of the basis vectors themselves. So they will be some, and the coefficients in that linear combination are the so-called structure constants of the algebra. Okay, so EI and EJ are two basis vectors. We multiply them, and this side is now a linear combination of the different basis vectors EK with coefficients FIJK, which are the structure constants, which are elements of the field F, capital F. Okay? But now, if I take any two vectors in the vector space and express them as a linear combination of the basis elements, so I'll write A as lambda I times EI, and I'll write A prime as some different coefficients, lambda I prime, let's say lambda J prime, times EJ, then their product, A times A prime, well, because it's bilinear, that just means that I can substitute this and this for this and this, and the field coefficients factor out. So I can write this as lambda I times lambda J prime times EI EJ, but then I know the product EI times EJ from this formula, so this whole thing is lambda I lambda J prime FIJK DK. Okay? So that's what an algebra is. It's just a vector space where I can also take the product of any two vectors and get another vector in this bilinear fashion. So let's look at a couple of examples that'll be important for us. So the first example of an algebra is the algebra of n by n matrices with whose entries are complex numbers. Okay, I'll write that as m sub n of C. And so, well, that's an algebra because, well, first of all, it's a vector space because if I take two matrices, M1 and M2, then their sum is also an n by n matrix. Okay, so they satisfy this property. Alternatively, if I take a complex number times a complex matrix, I get another complex matrix. So they satisfy this property. So great, they're a vector space. But then they're also an algebra. Whoops. They're also an algebra because in the usual way, I can just multiply two matrices, M1 times M2, to get another n by n matrix. And this is bilinear in exactly this sense, in the sense that if I... Okay, I think it's clear what I mean. So okay, so now let's consider a second example of an algebra. That will be this is an example that, first of all, is a very beautiful example that I love. But secondly, it is very helpful because the theme of the rest of the lecture will be that the four algebras in this example give a nice way to understand the classification of many other types of objects in mathematics. Okay, so these are the normed so-called normed division algebras. This is a special class of algebras. And I'll say what they are in a second. What this name normed and division algebra, what these adjectives mean. But there's a famous theorem that these are all the nice generalizations of the real and complex numbers. You know, we have these two number systems that we know and love, the real numbers and the complex numbers. And roughly speaking, you can ask, well, what other number systems are there out there that have the same cherished properties? And so the norm division, those are the norm division algebras, and it turns out there's only four of them. Okay, there's the real numbers and complex numbers. You double this guy to get this guy, but then if you double this guy again, you get another nice number system called the quaternions. And if you double it again, you get a fourth number system called the octonions. And then the game stops. And the theorem is that those are the only four normed division algebras. Okay. So what are they? Well, let's start. The real numbers, of course, you're already familiar with, but just to warm up for what comes next. So these are a one-dimensional algebra over the real numbers. Okay, so it's kind of a confusing case because in this case, the algebra that we're describing, the real numbers, and the field that it's over is the same thing because it's their equivalent, because it's just there's only one basis vector in this algebra. And so it's kind of a confusing case to start with, but anyway, so the only basis vector is 1 now, and now any element of the vector space can be written, because it's a real vector space, I can take an arbitrary real element of the field and multiply, a real scalar, and multiply it times my 1 basis vector. So I can take an arbitrary real number a0 and multiply it by 1, and that's a general element of the vector space. Okay, it's so trivial it's confusing. Let's go on to the two-dimensional case, which will hopefully make things clearer. So this is a 2D algebra where now the two basis vectors are 1 and I. It's a two-dimensional real algebra. So an arbitrary element will now be a linear combination of these two basis vectors with arbitrary real coefficients. Okay, so in other words, now an arbitrary element of the complex numbers is a real number a naught times the first basis vector plus a real number a one times the second basis vector. Okay, and now, okay, well, so back here, I forgot to mention, but remember that in order to so far, I've told you what the vector space is, but to make this thing into an algebra, I need to tell you how to take the product of any two basis vectors. Well, here there's only one basis vector, so the only thing I need to tell you is that when you multiply 1 times 1, the answer is 1. So that's all there is to this rule in this first case. So anyway, that's what the real numbers are if you regard them as an algebra. What about in this case? Well, now we need a little multiplication table that tells us how to take the product of any two basis vectors. And of course, you guys are all familiar with the multiplication table, but for pedagogical purposes, let's write it out here. So basis vector 1 times 1 is again 1. 1 times I, or I times 1, is I. And then I times I is minus 1. Okay, so this is the two-dimensional vector space. This is the rule for how the basis elements multiply. So voila, we have specified the algebra. So now, this is the first case where I can begin to tell you what it means to be a normed division algebra. So as you know, in the complex numbers, there's an operation of complex conjugation, where this is just a map that takes any complex number and maps it to a different one, where what we do is we don't flip the sign of the coefficient of 1, but we do flip the sign of the coefficient of I. Okay, and then once we do that, that's a convenient thing to do because now we can define a so-called norm. The norm of W is just W star times W. And this has the special property that when I take the norm of a product of two complex numbers, that it's equal to the product of their norms. Okay, so this is what we mean when we say that the algebra is normed, that it has a map, a function here that maps any element of the algebra to the real numbers. This is just a real number now, with this property that the norm of the product of any two numbers is the product of their norms. Okay, it's a property you're all familiar with from the complex numbers. And then the other thing is that in the complex numbers, any element except zero has a multiplicative inverse. In other words, you can divide by a complex number. In particular, if you have complex number w, then the inverse of w, 1 divided by w, is just w star over the norm of w. Okay? Great. So this is a normed division algebra. Okay, when we say it's normed, we mean it has a norm with this property, and then when it's a division algebra because any non-zero element you can divide by it. Okay, but so I know this was reviewing stuff that seems like old hat, but the point of doing it is that now we have all the formulas we need to make the presentation of the next two guys go very quickly. So what about the quaternions? So now this is a four-dimensional algebra. We double the complex numbers to get these. So now the basis elements are 1 and I, as before, but now we're going to add two more imaginary basis elements, j and k. And now we want to give, again, we want to give the multiplication rule, the multiplication table for these four basis elements to tell you what. So an arbitrary element of the algebra here, we would now write as a0 times 1 plus another real number a1 times I plus another real number a2 times j plus another real number a3 times k. And now to tell you the product on this algebra, we need to give you the multiplication table. So in principle, I need to give you this multiplication table, but in this case, it's easier to express the multiplication table in a different way, which is that, well, 1 squared, as always, is 1. Any imaginary squared is minus 1, just like in the complex numbers. So I squared equals j squared equals k squared equals minus 1. And then the only thing left in this table is, one times anything is that thing. That's really what I should say. So 1 times anything is that thing. So 1 times I is I, 1 times j is j, etc. And it's also equal to a times 1. Okay, so the only thing left in this multiplication table is when we multiply two different imaginaries, I times j or k times I or something like that. So that's represented conveniently by this picture. Okay. Where we write the three imaginaries as three points on a circle. We give the circle some orientation. And then the result of a product is obtained by going around the circle. So I times j is k, j times k is I, k times I is j. But then if I go in the other direction, the direction opposite to the arrow, there's a minus sign. So k times j would be minus I, because I'm going in the opposite direction from the arrow, okay? Okay, but so now I've told you what the vector space is, this four-dimensional real vector space. I've specified what the product is. Now, just as before, I can define a complex conjugate by flipping the signs of all the imaginary coefficients. So just as before, I'll define W star to be, I'll keep the, I won't change the sign of the first coefficient, but I will change the other signs. And the point now is that, once again, now, if we just define the norm in the same way as before, it again has this property. One can check that it again has this property, that the norm of a product of any two quaternions is the product of their norms. And in fact, that's a good exercise to check that, if you want to get to know the quaternions a little bit. And then also that any quaternion has an inverse element, which is its complex, which is its quaternionic conjugate, W star, divided by its norm. Okay, so it's again a norm division algebra. And finally, we have the Octonians. The Octonians O are an eight-dimensional algebra. Okay, wait, quick, break time. Sorry. I try to remember to take a break in the middle of every lecture. Try to keep from killing people. And this time I, in general, what I would love is that during break, the break is like a 1 minute break to clear everybody's mind. It could really be anything as long as it's entertaining and makes everybody happy and want to listen to the final 20 minutes of my lecture. So you know, like a tap dance routine or a joke or an interpretive dance about what I've just taught. Any of these things would be very, very welcome. A story about your brief summary of your dreams and aspirations. Anything would be allowed. But so today, I assumed you wouldn't be ready. Who knows? Am I wrong about that? Anybody want to be today's entertainment? No? Okay, so I printed out right before I came here the poem, "You Are Old Father William," from Alice in Wonderland. Here we go. I do not regularly perform poetry, so bear with me. "You are old, Father William," the young man said, "and your hair has become very white. And yet you incessantly stand on your head. Do you think at your age it is right?" I think it's very funny. I'm going to have trouble not laughing at this. "In my youth, Father William," replied to his son, "I feared it might injure my brain. But now that I'm perfectly sure I have none, why, I do it again and again." "You are old," said the youth, "as I mentioned before, and have grown most uncommonly fat. Yet you turned a back somersault in at the door. Pray, what is the reason of that?" "In my youth," said the sage, as he shook his gray locks, "I kept all my limbs very supple. By the use of this ointment, 1 shilling a box, allow me to sell you a couple." We're almost there. "You are old," said the youth, "and your jaws are too weak. You feel your energy replenishing, you're coming back, you're..." Okay. "You are old," said the youth, "and your jaws are too weak for anything tougher than suet. Yet you finished the goose with the bones and the beak. Pray, how did you manage to do it?" "In my youth," said his father, "I took to the law and argued each case with my wife. And the muscular strength which it gave to my jaw has lasted the rest of my life." That's. "You are old," said the youth. "One would hardly suppose that your eye was as steady as ever. Yet you balanced an eel on the end of your nose. What made you so awfully clever?" "I have answered 3 questions, and that is enough," said his father. "Don't give yourself airs. Do you think I can listen all day to such stuff? Be off, or I'll kick you downstairs." Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So now I got to move here. Okay. So. Now we're here to the jewel in the crown of the norm division algebras. So now we have an 8-dimensional algebra. Now it has a real basis vector and 7 imaginaries, I, J, K, as before, but now we're going to add a fourth independent imaginary, L. And then it's convenient to call the remaining three guys IL, JL, and KL. Okay, so those are my 7 imaginary basis elements. And so an arbitrary vector now will be some real number times 1 plus some other real number times I, and then dot, 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 plus some 7th real number times my 7th basis vector KL. As before, this thing will have a complex conjugate, which I define to be, or an octonionic conjugate, I should say, which I define to be minus A1I minus dot, 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 minus A7 times KL. And then now, the product rule for these basis elements is again simply summarized in a table, I mean in a picture. It's more easy to write a picture rather than write down the 8x8 table. So basically, as before, 1 times anything is that thing. Any imaginary squared is minus 1. And then we just need to tell you how to take the product of any 2 different imaginaries. So that's summarized in this diagram called the so-called Fano plane, which is analogous to the one to the circle we drew for the quaternions, but a little fancier. In fact, what it looks like is that I think this symbol appears in Harry Potter, doesn't it? I read Harry Potter to my daughter at some point after. Anyway, so okay, so. So what's the idea here? So the idea is that there's 7 points in this diagram, okay? The first 3 points are our old friends I, J, and K. And they live on this circle. And their product, this circle, tells you about how to take their product, just like it did before for the quaternions. But now there's 4 new points. There's this new point L. And then there are these 3 points at the corners. IL, JL, and KL. And so now the idea is that if you look at it, you know, if you pick any pair of the 7 imaginaries, you'll find that they lie on a unique line. So for example, L times K, well, they lie on this line. And the line you see is oriented this way. You're supposed to think of this line as a circle. I take the ends here and I join them up into a circle. Or alternatively, you're supposed to think of this circle as a line where I've joined its ends. Okay, so there's any 2 imaginaries lie on a line here, and the rule is the same as it was for the quaternions, that if I take the product of 2 guys on the line, the answer is the next guy on the line, or with a minus sign if I'm going in the direction opposite the arrow. So for example, K times L, I'm going with the arrow, so the answer is KL. But you know, L times K, I'm going direction opposite the arrow, so the answer is minus KL. Okay? Great, so that's what the octonions are, and again, we don't need to do any more work because, once again, the norm is just W star times W. For any octonion, you multiply it times its complex conjugate, and that turns out to be a real number, which is its norm. It obeys this property again, so it's a normed algebra. If it's not 0, then it has an inverse, which is given by this formula again. Okay, great. So those are the 4 norm division algebras, and then let me try to quickly explain why I introduced them. Okay, this last part will be a little bit of a whirlwind, but so be it. Anything truly important will be covered again later. Okay, so far we've met two algebras, the n by n matrices and the norm division algebras, another type that's important for us. The third example of an algebra are Lie algebras. Okay, so what's a Lie algebra? Well, it's a vector space equipped with a product. Any algebra is that. And what makes it a Lie algebra is that there's something special about this product. It satisfies two additional properties. One is that it's antisymmetric, so A times B, product of two vectors A and B, is the opposite of the product of B times A. And the second thing is that if I first take the product of A and B, and then take their product with C, and then I add to that the cyclic permutations of A, B, and C, that's zero. And this is the so-called Jacobi identity. Okay, so if you have an algebra whose product satisfies these two properties, you have a Lie algebra. And usually when you write down a Lie algebra, you don't write the product this way. It's convention to notate it like this with a bracket. And once we do that, you recognize this as a well-known property of the commutator of two matrices. And similarly here, we would now write this thing as we first take the product of those, and then we take the product of that with C. And similarly here, first take the product of B and C, i.e. we take their commutator, and then we take the product with A. Similarly here. Okay, and so now this you may, these are now both identities you recognize from matrix working with commutators of matrices, and in particular this may be the version of the Jacobi identity that you are more familiar with. So the Lie algebras, the finite dimensional, simple, classical, the simple Lie algebras have been classified. There's a famous classification, and in short they come in three infinite families and a couple exceptional cases. And it's very convenient to describe those infinite families and that classification in terms of the norm division algebras as follows. So what are the three infinite families of Lie algebras? Well, there's SON. What are those? Well, those are the set of matrices, n by n real matrices, with the property that X dagger is equal to minus X. Now, if it's a real matrix, X dagger just means X transpose, because there is no conjugation operation in this case. So in this case, I'm just using X dagger to make it fit with what comes next. But so these are all the matrices that satisfy real matrices that are anti-symmetric and traceless. And now, if you take the commutator of any two such matrices, you'll see you find another matrix which again has these properties. So they do close, form a closed algebra with the commutator. So that's what SON is. SUN, the next set of Lie algebras in the classification, are a set of all n by n complex matrices, again, that are anti-Hermitian, so X dagger is equal to minus X, and traceless. And then the third classical family of Lie algebras, SPN, the symplectic group, the symplectic Lie algebras, are the set of all n by n matrices whose elements are quaternions, and again, satisfy this property that they're anti-Hermitian. Okay, in this case, it turns out we don't have the trace condition. Okay, but so these are all of the classical Lie algebras. These are the three infinite families that appear in the classification of Lie algebras. And then there's just, and you see they're neatly summarized. They're all the same, basically, except that you change that whether the matrix elements are real numbers, complex numbers, or quaternions. And then, famously, there are five more Lie algebras left over, five exceptional cases, which are called G2, F4, E6, E7, and E8. And these guys, okay, I don't have a chance to explain it now, but these guys are, you might guess from this pattern that maybe anything left over would have to do with the octonions, and indeed that's exactly right. These guys do indeed come from the octonions by a construction called the magic square, which I will be explaining later in the course. And so, first of all, there you go. Those are all the Lie algebras that you can use to build your gauge theories, your Yang-Mills theories in particle physics. And you see they're most neatly summarized in terms of the norm division algebras. And a pattern emerges, which then happens again and again throughout mathematics, which is that whenever you classify, well, maybe not whenever, but very commonly it happens in mathematics that when you classify, you find some interesting set of objects and you try to classify them, you find there are a few infinite families, which are sort of the normal cases. And those infinite families correspond to the first three norm division algebras. And then there are a couple, just a handful, a finite set of leftover cases that don't fit the classification, in this case, these guys. And those guys owe their existence to the octonions. So let's do another example. OK, I just have one minute more. Well, do I? Yeah. I went slow. I'll take 2 minutes more. OK, groups. To quickly remind you, what is a group? Well, this is a set of elements where it's simpler than an algebra. In an algebra, there were various different things you could do. You could add elements, you could multiply vectors, you could multiply by scalars. A group is a simpler thing. It's a set of elements where there's just one operation defined. You can take the product of two elements, G1 and G2, and the product is, again, an element of the group. And it has basically three properties, that there's an identity element, one, in the group. So that 1 times g is equal to g times 1 is equal to g, any g. And it's associative. So g1 times g2 times g3, if you take this product first and then multiply by this guy, that's the same as if we first take the product of the second two guys and then take the product with the first guy. And every element g has an inverse element, g minus 1, so that g minus 1 times g is equal to g times g minus 1 is equal to 1. OK, so that's what a group is. Groups could have a finite number of elements, or they could have an infinite number of elements. For physics, a very important type of group is a Lie group, which is a group that's also a manifold. So here's some manifold. And now the idea is that every point on the manifold is an element of the group. So I take this point on the manifold, that's one element, g1. I take this point on the manifold, that's another element, g2. And now I can take their, because it's also a group, I can take the product of these two points and get a third point on the manifold, g1 times g2. OK. And now, in short, since it's a manifold, near every point there's a little vector space, the tangent space to the manifold. And the tangent space to the manifold, in particular some point here, is the identity element. The tangent space to the manifold near the identity is nothing but the Lie algebra that exponentiates to give this Lie group. So let's say we have some Lie algebra, A, and it has some elements, x. And now we take e to the x. We exponentiate those elements and let x vary over all the different elements in A. Then now we, as we let x vary, the element g, the exponential of x, also varies. And these elements g form the elements of a Lie group. OK, and so the classification of the simple compact Lie groups follows immediately from the classification of Lie algebras. And in particular, all we have to do here is change these into what they would be in if we exponentiated these conditions, well, what would happen? This would say that x dagger x is g in my new notation. These are now the n by n matrices, g which are n by n real, n by n complex, or n by n quaternion, and with the property that g dagger g is equal to 1. That's what this condition becomes when we exponentiate it. And then in this top case, the trace condition, when we exponentiate that, that says the determinant of g is 1. And again, these are the three infinite classical families of Lie groups. And then again, there's five special cases left over. Noted capital G2, capital F4, capital E6, capital E7, and capital E8. And again, just like these guys follow from the magic square, so do their associated Lie groups. OK, I was going to give a number of other examples of this pattern, because it really is very universal. And there's a couple other cases where it will appear later in the course, including in the classification of Jordan algebras, where there's, just like here, we classified and there were a couple infinite families corresponding to these simple division algebras, and then there were five exceptional cases. Well, there's another important kind of algebra called a Jordan algebra. Again, those were classified by Wigner and von Neumann and Jordan. And again, there's a few infinite cases, normal cases, which correspond to these three guys. And then now, in that case, there's just one exceptional case left over, which corresponds to the 3x3, the matrix of 3x3 Hermitian matrices with Octonian elements. Anyway, okay, that's all. I fell a little bit short, but nothing that we'll need for the next lecture. So the other stuff, if we need it, I'll come back to it later in the course. So tomorrow I'll do all. Tomorrow next lecture will be a review of gauge theory and Flashing-Mills theory, and then by the third lecture we'll be dealing with the standard model itself. Any questions? Yeah.
Why do we stop at 8 dimensions?
So there's a theorem that these are the only algebras over the real numbers that have these two properties, that there's a function from the algebra to the real numbers, which satisfies this norm of the product as product of the norms rule, and such that every element has it's a division algebra. Every element has a multiplicative every non-zero element has a multiplicative inverse, and you can't, relatedly, you can't multiply two non-zero elements to get zero. Now, another way to say it is that there's this prescription called the Cayley-Dickinson prescription, which gives a general rule for, you start with the real numbers and you apply this prescription once, you get the complex numbers, you apply it again, you get, it's a doubling prescription that tells you how to get from one multiplication table to the next one, basically. And you can apply that again to go from, you can double the Octonians to get a 16-dimensional algebra called the Sidonians. They are still normed, but they fail to be a division algebra. So this is all there is. The proof that this is all there is, though, is, it's not. It's not easy to state. All right. Okay.